Before we get started, I would like to bring your attention to the next Americano Live event. The last one was a huge success, and we anticipate this one will be as big, if not bigger, to get all Trumpy about it. It's Americano Live's Trump's First 100 Days. I will be hosting it, and I will be joined by the great Lionel Shriver. We will be talking about all things Trump. There's a hell of a lot to cover, but we'll do our best to cover the lot. Do join us. It's at the Emanuel Centre on Wednesday, the 30th of April. And the discussion, according to the blurb here, the discussion starts at 7:30 p.m. Book your tickets at spectator.co.uk/Shriver, which is spelled S-H-R-I-V-E-R, as I'm sure you already knew. Please come.
Hello and welcome to Spectator Out Loud. Each week we choose some of our favourite articles from the magazine and ask their writers to read them aloud. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and on this week's podcast, reacting to the news of Marine Le Pen's ban from standing in elections, Gavin Mortimer looks at how the French right can still win. Colin Freeman interviews the American soldiers who fought in Ukraine and feel betrayed by Trump. Lawrence Osborne reads his diary from Bangkok, where the city is still reeling from an earthquake last week. Inspired by her parents' almost too happy marriage, Lionel Shriver argues we should stick up for traditional monogamy against a world of dating apps and singledom. And finally, Anthony Cummings examines media satire and settled scores as he reviews Natasha Brown's Universality. Up first, Gavin Mortimer.
It has been a terrible year for the Le Pen family. Jean-Marie died in the first week of January. He was the patriarch who in 1972 co-founded the National Front and grew it into a formidable political machine before handing over to his daughter. Marine took command in 2011 and, through a strategy of de-demonisation, transformed the rebranded National Rally into the biggest single party in the National Assembly with 125 seats. She's reached the second round of the last two presidential elections, but it won't be third time lucky for Marine Le Pen. On Monday, a judge disqualified her from politics for 5 years for misusing EU funds between 2004 and 2016. Le Pen was also given a 4-year suspended prison sentence and fined €100,000. 24 other members of her party, including 8 MEPs, were given lesser sentences for what the judge described as well-organised malfeasance. It was accepted that neither she nor her co-accused had personally enriched themselves with the €2.9 million from the EU coffers, but in using the money to finance the party, the judge said that Le Pen had circumvented democracy. Le Pen stormed out of the court before the sentence was passed, but she'd calmed down by the evening when she appeared live on television. Nevertheless, she was in combative mood. "It's not just me who has been eliminated," she declared. "It's millions of French people whose votes have been eliminated." She described the sentence as a political decision and a violation of the state of law. Le Pen confirmed that she will appeal the judgment, and she also had a message for her 11 million voters. "Don't worry, I'm not demoralised, I'm outraged." Her appeal will be heard next year with a decision made that summer, so time is not on her side, given that the presidential election will be held in April 2027. There is a high chance her appeal may not even be successful. So what are the options for the National Rally, assuming Marine Le Pen has been permanently cancelled? Many see an obvious successor in Jordan Bardella, the 29-year-old president of a National Rally, who last year spearheaded the party's triumphant European election campaign. A poll conducted last week revealed that 60% of National Rally supporters prefer Bardella to Le Pen. These will likely be younger voters or more bourgeois ones. Living as I do in Burgundy, a National Rally stronghold, I am acquainted with several people who admire Bardella, and they fall into these two demographics. I also know voters who are loyal to Le Pen. They are middle-aged and working class. A couple of decades ago, they voted for the left, but they gravitated towards the Le Pens because father and daughter expressed what they thought about the ravages of deindustrialization, the problems of mass immigration, and the overreach of the European Union. While Le Pen is routinely described as far right, economically she is statist. In an interview earlier this year, she was asked how she would reduce France's exorbitant civil service wage bill. She brushed off the question, exclaiming, "No, no, that's right-wing stuff." Even on questions of identity, she's hardly a hardliner. in a debate in 2021 with Gérard Darmanin, then the Minister of the Interior and now the Minister of Justice, Le Pen was accused of being soft on Islamism. But Le Pen will always be the darling of a white working class because, like them, she carries the scars of an arduous life. She survived a bomb attack in her family home when she was 8. She had a very acrimonious falling out with her father when she expelled him from the party for his anti-Semitism. And she has faced her share of political humiliation, such as when Emmanuel Macron shamed her in a live television debate in 2017. It's not just the British who admire a plucky and indomitable underdog, so do the French. Her latest setback will only increase her appeal for her many admirers, even if she is unable to stand. If Bardella is officially anointed as Le Pen's successor, will he be able to appeal to the Le Pen loyalists? It will certainly take some work to win over the older working classes. Ironically, he is genuinely working class, unlike the bourgeois Le Pen, having grown up in the notoriously tough district of Saint-Saint-Denis in northern Paris. Bardella is handsome and courteous, as well as a little bland, which doesn't necessarily endear him to Le Pen's tribe. In recent months, some National Rally voters have accused Bardella of moving too far towards the centre. This prompted the left-wing newspaper Le Monde to write about the Macronisation of Bardella. Certainly Bardella's response to Donald Trump's victory last year could have come from the lips of the French president. There was no sense of triumph at the victory of an anti-establishment outsider. Rather, Bardella expressed his anxiety about what it might mean for Europe in terms of defence, industry, agriculture and energy policy. Perhaps there was some sense to this. Since Trump took office, both Le Pen and Bardella have been strangely subdued. It may have been part of their strategy of respectability, of portraying themselves as Democrats, not demagogues, in the hope the judge would go easy on them. Fat lot of good that did. Le Pen may never comprehend that the bourgeois left, prevalent among the elite of the media, judiciary, art and academia, will hate her to the grave. She can de-demonise her party as much as she likes, but she will always be a Le Pen, the daughter of a man the 1968 generation characterised as the devil incarnate. But in many ways, her disqualification creates an interesting opportunity for the National Rally and more broadly the French right. Last year, Bardella published his memoir, Ce que je cherche, What I'm Looking For, in which he wrote, "The idea of uniting working-class French people and part of a conservative bourgeoisie in a single movement, as Nicolas Sarkozy did in 2007, is a good one. This conservative bourgeoisie once voted overwhelmingly for the centre-right Republicans, the party of Sarkozy. When Sarkozy was elected president in 2007, the Republicans won 313 of the 577 seats in the subsequent parliamentary elections. Today they are down to 39. Much like the Tories, the Republicans have moved too far to the centre in recent years, while failing to address the concerns of their voters about immigration and economic insecurity. One consequence of this was the emergence of Eric Zemmour, who launched his Reconquest Party in 2021 and polled 2.4 million votes in the 2022 presidential election, 800,000 more than the Republicans. Le Pen and Zemmour are enemies, a result of her refusal to enter into a coalition with Reconquest in 2022. Bardella is more responsive, and in his autobiography, he said he agreed with much of Zemmour's diagnosis about what had gone wrong with France. Meanwhile, Marion Maréchal, Marine's niece, served until last year as the vice president of Reconquest. Like Zemmour, Maréchal is more economically liberal and more socially conservative than her aunt. Le Pen was emotionally hurt when Maréchal joined Zemmour's party in 2022, but it was a short-lived switch. Maréchal fell out with Zemmour during last year's parliamentary elections when she called for an alliance with a National Rally. Maréchal, an MEP, now heads her own party, Identity and Freedom, which consists of her and two other MEPs. She is, once more, a close ally of the National Rally. An interesting detail to note, too, is that Maréchal is close to Giorgia Meloni. Her husband is Italian and a former MEP in Meloni's Brothers of Italy party. Maréchal, Bardella and the French right may now be looking to Italy's Prime Minister for inspiration in the post-Le Pen world. In 2022, Meloni triumphed in Italy's general election as the leader of a right-wing coalition. She and her deputy PM, Matteo Salvini, have their ideological differences, but they overcame them and their reward was power. If the French right is to triumph, it will need to show similar political maturity. And that includes the Republican Party. One of their senior figures, Laurent Wauquiez, said earlier this year that the only barrier to forming an alliance with a national rally was that they don't have the same ideas in the economy. In other words, the Republicans have no problem with the national rally's view on mass immigration and law and order. So, while it has been a terrible year for the Le Pen family, it could turn out to be a transformative one for the national rally, but only if it reaches out to other parties and creates a broader movement. If not, there is a possibility that a left-wing coalition will propel Jean-Luc Mélenchon to power.
That was Gavin Mortimer, and next, Colin Freeman.
The Ukrainians of Alabama are not the kind of lobbyists whose visits strike fear into pro-Trump politicians in Washington. An ad hoc campaign group of expats and refugees, they do their best to politely put Kiev's case to representatives of Congress and Senate. They do, however, have a secret weapon in the form of an ex-US soldier from the town of Tuscaloosa, whose backstory is the kind that the Beltway finds hard to ignore. 42-year-old Alex Druk is an Iraq veteran whose ancestors served in every major American war since the War of Independence. Appalled at Vladimir Putin's invasion, he joined Ukraine's International Legion, only to be captured on his first mission. Becoming the first American POW in Moscow's hands since Francis Gary Powers in 1960. He suffered 4 months of beatings and torture before being freed in a prisoner swap in late 2022, and he now uses his fame to advocate for Ukraine. We bring different perspectives, whether it's wider concerns about Trump's plans for Ukraine or my own direct experience of Russian war crimes, says Druk, who also talks to high schools, church groups, and pretty much anywhere else that will have him. But occasionally, someone will hear my story and go, "Ah, so you're that guy from the news." Being an ex-POW doesn't have quite the sway that it used to in Republican circles. In 2015, Donald Trump was openly dismissive of John McCain, who spent 5 years in a North Vietnamese prison camp. So for Trump audiences, Druk brings a message closer to home. The big talking point of Trump voters is migration on the Mexican border, so I use that as a tool, he says. I tell him, look, you believe the Mexicans are invading, taking our jobs, draining our social services and so on, right? Well, imagine someone invading and obliterating entire cities, murdering and raping, because that's what the Russians are doing in Ukraine. How would you feel about that? These days, however, even that kind of ploy has limited traction. Druk had always expected Trump to be cooler on Ukraine than Biden, but was still appalled by the recent press conference in which J.D. Vance accused Volodymyr Zelensky of ingratitude for U.S. help. For the first time in my life, I was ashamed of being an American, he says. That is probably putting politely. Among other Americans still serving in Ukraine, the US president's name is seldom mentioned these days without profanity. Trump's a fucking coward, says Charles Carter, another US volunteer. He regrets that Trump's would-be assassin only managed to nick his ear last July. The fact that that bullet missed his face by only an inch is a worldwide travesty. The strength of feeling is hardly surprising, given how many Americans have gone to fight in Ukraine and how passionately they embrace the cause. US citizens are thought to be the largest foreign group in the Legion, with several thousand having served in the past 3 years. At least 50 have died, with many more seriously injured. It's the biggest mobilization of its sort since the Spanish Civil War, when 3,000 Americans joined the International Brigade against Franco's fascists, inspiring Hemingway's novel For Whom the Bell Tolls. But while most of them were card-carrying communists, those in Ukraine see themselves defending a much more American ideal of democracy and freedom. Many, like Druk, are veterans of America's messy campaigns in the Middle East and can be as sceptical as Trump about US intervention abroad. They point out, though, that almost uniquely in modern history, Ukraine has proved a reliable security partner. Unlike its counterparts in Iraq, Afghanistan and South Vietnam, neither Ukraine's army nor its government has collapsed. And unlike much of Western Europe, it doesn't expect America to do its fighting for it. Many of us feel very betrayed by Trump's actions towards the country we fought and died for, and also somewhat baffled, says Andy, a US combat medic who fought in Ukraine until 2023. The strategic implications of screwing over our allies are massive, as our own prosperity depends a lot on our ability to project power and stability in trade. A sense of betrayal is all the greater, given that many US volunteers tend to lean Republican. Some have voted for Trump in the past and saw service in Ukraine as a break from an America obsessed with identity politics. Like the rest of the bro vote fraternity, they're keen on guns, MMA fighting, and Joe Rogan. Indeed, when the war started, many got huge followings on social media while posting footage of their battlefield exploits alongside running commentaries on the war. To followers back in the US, they were a reassuring reminder of America's warrior spirit. Now, though, despite their best efforts as the war's social influencers, they see their chances of victory dimming, just as their predecessors eventually lost to Franco. And much as the likes of Druk carry on campaigning, others who might normally be powerful allies are silent. For the dead volunteers all leave behind grieving families, known in the US as Gold Star families. The term dates back to the First World War, when bereaved households would fly a flag with a gold star outside their homes, and has continued ever since. But while Gold Star families of Vietnam or Iraq will showcase their status on a flag or tie pin, those who have lost loved ones in Ukraine often stay quiet because of pro-Russian trolling. It isn't just a case of the odd rude comment posted online. Families are sometimes targeted by professional Russian hackers who do all they can to aggravate their grief. One of the few to speak out on this subject is John Frank, whose son Ian died in Ukraine in 2023. He says that while he is happy to be identified, many Gold Star families aren't. Some of the fallen were killed while behind enemy lines. Parents have sent graphic photos of their sons' bodies, he says. One father viewed a video of his son's execution on the battlefield. A lot of the harassment is via Russian trolls, but a few ignorant Americans have joined in. Russians want to ensure that no American is ever acknowledged for their sacrifice. They want to divide us. Hence, it seems, the absence of much organized lobbying from bereaved families, who are traditionally a strong voice in influencing US military policy. Yet even without the trolling, it is debatable whether Trump would agree to see them anyway. Unlike Zelensky, at February's press conference, the Gold Star families would have nothing much left to lose by speaking their mind. To borrow Trump's phrase, the conversation would no doubt make great television.
That was Colin Freeman, now Lawrence Osborne.
Last Friday, I was on my 15th floor balcony with an early afternoon coffee, watching dogs play among the banana trees below. It was strangely quiet. Looking across the skyscrapers that form my horizon, I noticed the 137 Pillars, a luxury high-rise hotel famous for its rooftop pool, perched 37 stories above my own street. Down that tower, great cascades of water, thousands of gallons, were pouring from the rooftop pool. I looked at the jungle plants on my balcony. They were moving back and forth, the blades of the rubber trees swaying as if issuing a warning, and I felt dizzy. Soon all the towers around me were exploding with the same cascades of pool water. For a few seconds before I had realized anything, I thought, how beautiful. Then I stood up and keeled over. The whole building was moving. Then the rubber trees toppled. Not a hangover, I thought calmly as I wandered out into the private landing of my condo, and then the communal open bridges which connect all the units on the same floor. People I had never seen before, after 12 years of living next to them, had suddenly appeared, running half-dressed or almost naked towards the fire exit stairs. Old people, stunned Japanese salarymen in steep decline, a few Thai pop stars, and a horde of Pomeranians carried in arms. In the last 100 years, there has hardly ever been an earthquake in Bangkok. They are more a Burmese or a Javan thing. Now it was a 7.7 monster with its epicenter indeed in Myanmar, but it had reached the Thai capital with enormous force. I was barefoot and shirtless, as one is on the balcony in 95 degrees heat. But as I turned to go back to my apartment, staff members came up with outspread arms and made it known that this was not an option. "But what about my little dog?" I shouted. "No time for little dog, sir. Only running and not dying." Pieces of plaster and dust were now falling from the great roof above us, windows shattering, and the massive cement building was groaning and creaking as it swayed, thousands of tons of concrete beginning to crack. I was swept up in the downward panic towards the distant ground floor. The sweltering staircase was lit only by the windows on each landing, which looked down over the communal swimming pool on the second floor. Its normally placid, pale blue rectangle had been turned into a boiling mass of concussed waves. The water sloshed all over the floors and had burst through a balustrade at the far end. This seemed to create in the minds of my fellow tenants a special sense of horror as they passed the windows and looked down. Is not the swimming pool the ultimate symbol of oasis-like serenity and peace, almost a guarantee that order reigns? In the street, meanwhile, a crowd of tenants sat gazing up at the great white tower, as if waiting for it to collapse. The police arrived. The place was closed off and no one was to re-enter. Hours passed. Drenched in sweat and wet dust, we waited for an all-clear. The similar towers all around us had taken on an ominously abandoned quality. The skyscraper, or condo tower, those confident assurances that our technology is infallible and that our lifestyles are timeless, had turned in the space of a few minutes into promises of nothing better than future doom, burial under rubble. In the burning air, the particles of debris seemed to hover as if they had nowhere to go. But I was thinking about Whiskey, my little dog. Still barefoot, I ignored the protests of the staff and went into the abandoned lobby, where chunks of plaster lay all over the floor. I began to climb my way back to my apartment, up the same staircase by which I had descended. But now I was alone, and I was probably alone in the whole building. It was the most Balladian moment of the whole day. Fear of death, of being buried under masonry. I found Whiskey cowering in my bathroom. I scooped him up and re-emerged into the landings where the immense walls were still subtly moving. Over the years, I've often heard that the building is haunted by all the people who have died in it peacefully. It seemed realistic now. Rejoining the crowd, I was struck by how calm and good-humoured it was, a Thai resilience smoothly working under the surface. Moreover, I could see that my building, which I take for granted, is in fact a society in miniature. Sentimentally, you could say that only cosmic near-misses make this obvious to the isolated and self-obsessed tenant. In a city of more than 11 million, only one building collapsed entirely. A new, supposedly earthquake-resistant tower in Chetachuk, built by a Chinese company sinisterly named China Railway No. 10 in cooperation with the Thai government. Needless to say, it disintegrated in seconds, killing dozens. The company was later determined to have used substandard steel. Four Chinese nationals were arrested for entering the site to retrieve incriminating documents. Well, I heard one of my co-tenants say in the street, so much for the crappy future. What struck me later that night as we sat again on the balcony and looked out at that same future was how quickly normality resumed. Normality is a facet of human genius. No warplanes were trying to kill us. The city was not in ruins, not yet anyway. The dogs were back in the banana plantation. My own dog was asleep in a rattan chair. No doubt the pools had been refilled. There was only one residue, if we lay to one side the grief-stricken families assembled at the site of the collapsed Chinese building in Chatuchak, fear itself. The cars were moving again. The streets had emptied out, but the fear will likely remain forever in some form or other. The other human genius, fear of the future.
That was Lawrence Osborne, and next, Lionel Shriver.
My late parents perpetually promoted their marriage as the best in the history of the universe. Because this cult of two was hardly subtle, others readily detected what they wanted to hear. So fawning social admiration of what lovebirds they were made them even worse. For us kids, this Trumpesque superlative, how they'd hate that adjective, wasn't remotely as traumatizing as divorce, but still the romantic hagiography was a bit much. In our adulthoods, our own sad little relationships could never compare, and our parents seemed to feel sorry for us. While big proponents of marriage as an institution, they seem to regard their children's marriages as pale imitations. You know, nice try, kids. Even if they sometimes wielded their contentment as a cudgel, I'm glad they were happy together. Though I tied the knot late at 46, I've followed in their matrimonial footsteps for more than two decades. For me, then, the Wall Street Journal's lengthy feature last month, "American Women Are Giving Up on Marriage," sounded a sorrowful note. In the U.S., in 2022, only a third of single women were looking for love. In defiance of the old commitment-phobe cliché, more than half of single men were on the market. Over half of women aged 18 to 40 are neither married nor cohabiting, a figure that's risen by 10% this century. In a 2023 poll, nearly half of women didn't regard marriage as that important for a fulfilling life, compared with 39% of men, rising from 31% and 28% only 4 years earlier. Last year, only 47% of American households were headed by married couples in 1949. That figure was 79%. Rates of marriage have also plummeted in the UK. As of last year, fewer than half of British adults were married. Marriages per 1,000 single British adults have fallen from about 74 in 1972 to 19 in 2022. What's happened? Women are finding it difficult to find men they don't hold in contempt. Many more women than men now have degrees, and women are reluctant to marry down. Men's and women's political views have diverged, and women seem less focused on romantic love. In Disney's infamously woke remake of Snow White, our heroine no longer pines, "Someday my prince will come." The song was cut. Her mission is no longer to find a man, but to locate her inner strength, and the prince has been demoted to Jonathan. Clearly, decreasing interest in marriage is multifactorial. But I'd add a couple of factors that the journal didn't mention. Dating apps don't allow for accident. They don't allow for that old Rolling Stone distinction between getting what you want and getting what you need. An algorithm is the wrong tool for finding someone whose company you can freakishly tolerate. Better to use a Ouija board, or take a proper chance for once and catch a stranger's eye across a crowded room. No way would eHarmony have ever set me up with my husband. I didn't know what I needed. My conscious preferences would have paired me with posturing intellectuals who went to Princeton. I'd never have ticked boxes that landed me with a jazz drummer with no advanced degree. No algorithm would have detected this musician and I have the same dry, absurdist sense of humor. No algorithm could have discerned his acute, intuitive intelligence without a CV to prove it. I don't think we're unusual either. Plenty of solid, long-standing marriages would never have looked plausible on paper. This whole checklist mentality should be consigned to the supermarket. Moreover, maybe women are too picky. We're not always such great shakes ourselves. Women's widespread insistence on tallness is just as unfair and shallow as men's insistence that women be size zero when they themselves are 5 stone overweight. What's wrong with people is often endearing. I'm no paragon, and I'd hate to be married to one. The epigraph to my 8th novel, The Post-Birthday World, runs, "Nobody's perfect. Known fact." It's a parallel universe book in which the protagonist lives a slightly different life, depending on which man she chooses. Readers often try to decide with which chap she's better off. But in truth, both the exciting snooker player and the reliable, decent think tank wonk are credible objects of her affection, each of whom redeems himself or disappoints, depending on the day. The novel opposes the concept of courtly love, that there's one ideal mate out there earmarked for you, and good luck finding your needle in a haystack. No, no, just make hay while the sun shines with somebody, optimally with a guy who doesn't mind farmyard cliches. Plummeting marriage rates must be related to dropping fertility rates. Both statistics represent the subversion of family that my generation instigated. Maybe the decay has advanced far enough. Although when younger I fought both the idea of family and my actual family, I benefited from being raised by parents with a happy marriage, even one too happy, if there's such a thing. Should we be talking up formalized monogamy more? See, I like being married. I like the clarity. One side of my life is resolved. I like going away alone and coming home to company. I like solitude when my husband goes away, and I like it when he comes back. I like spending all day ignoring him, and I like getting reacquainted when I finally notice there's someone else in the house. If one of us ever leaves the other, it will be in a box. We are extremely different. Had I been born to a generation that shops for men online like socks, I'd surely have searched for someone just like me, which would have been a disaster. Mind, my husband drives me insane. I announce with regularity, I have no idea why I married you. Fortunately, I drive him insane right back. Sometimes we do a fuse about having the best marriage in the history of the universe, but in private. And it's a joke.
That was Lionel Shriver, and finally, Anthony Cummings.
In 2023, Natasha Brown published an article taking the reader behind the scenes of two interviews that she had given to newspapers in Australia and Spain while promoting her debut novel, Assembly. The point was to expose sleight of hand in the resulting write-ups, to say nothing of shabby conduct more generally. One interviewer, eager for her to admit that I was influenced by two television shows which aired after my novel went to print, asked, apropos of nothing, if she had a boyfriend. It's not clear whether this question came from the creased printout he regularly consults, wrote Brown, acidly. Skewering journalistic pretension to authority is the main business of Universality, which centres on a fictitious magazine feature, printed at the start and shown in later chapters to be a tissue of deceit. What he'd believed was a shared understanding had proved to be a cruel confidence trick, thinks one interviewee. The piece, a viral success optioned for TV, concerns an activist who was brained by a gold bar at a lockdown-breaking rave that implicates a banker, as well as a shit-stirring columnist, Miriam Leonard, known as Lenny, the author of a book called No Mo Woke, still a popular hashtag. Intrigue about Brown's purpose keeps us rapt. Although the grip and detail is shaky, it's both viciously accurate and weirdly off the mark, the novel impressively sustains tension, even menace, in an ultra-targeted send-up, with more than a suggestion of scores being settled. Nothing escapes satire. When the struggling reporter behind the article reflects miserably on the short-lived boost the piece gave her career, she resigns herself to yet again scrapping around for the same old freelance work, 500-word summaries, of the latest multicultural dreck passing for contemporary women's fiction. Universality culminates in a riveting set piece at a book festival, where a young woman tells Lenny she wouldn't mind getting into journalism herself. Lenny muses. Did she fancy exploiting herself for pennies per word, grinding out culture war fodder and outrage bait with zero scope for flair or individuality, cheap commodity labour, temporarily serving the algorithm that would one day replace her entirely? Shadowing the novel's unforgiving anatomy of everything awry with the trade is a sense that we might yet miss it once it's gone.
And that's everything for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed this podcast, we'd really appreciate a rate and a review wherever you subscribe to your podcasts. I'm Patrick Gibbons, and I hope you join us again next week.